You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
First Nations listeners are advised that the following program may contain the names and voices of our mob who have passed on to the Dreaming. Something else I just wanted to talk a bit about today is, of course, the housing situation. So if you just tuned in, you're listening to Yelaman on 3CR, and in an hour from now, actually, there is going to be a housing demonstration down at 1 Spring Street in the CBD, where public housing residents are demanding a meeting with the housing minister. And then this is going to turn into a bit of a larger demonstration from 1 o'clock, where people will be taking their petitions to the housing minister and protesting outside of their office down in the CBD. So head down for that one if you are free and available today. But while we're on the topic of housing, I thought I might have a bit of a yarn about it today. Pardon me. Sorry, I've got a bit of an itchy throat today. I thought I'd have a bit of a yarn about it today because, you know, housing is one of those major issues. It's one of those issues that we often see spoken about in the media, that we see a lot spoken about on social media. Of course, there are all of these current issues around housing, you know, stuff like the demolition or the planned demolition of the public housing tower blocks down here in so-called Victoria, across the city of so-called Melbourne, as well as, you know, the rising cost of housing, the rising cost of rent, you know, the way that more and more people are becoming ineligible for stuff like mortgages and whatever else. So I thought I would have a bit of a ramble about this today, because, you know, at the end of the day, like, we all know that something is wrong here. You know, we know that people are paying half their income on rent. You know, some people are paying even more than half of their income on rent. You know, we've got most young people I've spoken to have, you know, they've completely given up on the idea of ever owning a home. You know, they don't believe that they're ever going to be in a situation where they can own their own home. We've got people who are living in tents, in cars, in caravans. You know, we've got people who are couch surfing, and some people who have been couch surfing for months, if not years. You know, so we got to really ask what's causing it. Now, obviously the answer is capitalism, but we have to delve a bit more into this. So, you know, something as well I want to do while I'm having a bit of a yarn about this is address some of the lies that exist. You know, because there is a lot of lies and false propaganda out there that seek to point the finger and blame people who aren't actually responsible for the housing issue. You know, as a really great example of that, we've seen over the last year or two, and, you know, don't get me wrong, it's an issue that has always persisted here since 1788, but, you know, over the last couple of years in particular, we've really seen a rise in this rhetoric around blaming migrants and immigrants for the housing crisis. Now, you know, I want to just touch on this. I'm going to touch on this more as we go through as well and talk about some of the stats and figures that completely debunk this. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's not the case. And two things I just want to quickly touch on here is, one, like, what an ironic thing to hear all of these, you know, right-wing pundits pushing and saying that, you know, it's somehow the fault of immigration, that there isn't enough housing. Well, you know, to be fair, and in a defense, I suppose, if we go back far enough, if we go back to 1788, then yeah, we can actually point the finger at immigrants for the housing crisis that persists in Australia today. But it's not the immigrants that they're pointing their finger at. You know, it's not people who are migrating and immigrating from the global south. It's not people who are black and brown or, you know, otherwise non-white. It was the First Fleet that came in and, you know, dispossessed all of the land here from First Nations people and set us on this inevitable path to where we are today. But yes, it's not the fault of migrants or immigrants today that there isn't enough housing. In fact, you know, something I'm just going to address is that there actually is enough housing. You know, we hear about the fact that there's apparently not enough housing and, you know, we haven't built enough homes, which is another thing that, you know, people try and blame the housing crisis on. And, you know, they point at things like environmental regulations, or they try and blame local council, or, you know, all of these other excuses. But the fact of the matter is we do actually have enough houses already. You know, if the problem was simply that we don't have enough houses, how do we explain the fact that on the last census night, there was over 1 million unoccupied private dwellings across Australia, while there were 122,000 people homeless out on the street. Over a million empty houses and just over 100,000 homeless people. You know, homeless individuals, not homeless families. We've literally got enough empty houses to house the entire homeless population of this continent seven times over. And, you know, I'm not talking about giving a home to homeless families. I'm talking about we could give every individual homeless man, woman, and child a bunch of houses and we'd still have empty houses left over. So, you know, the issue isn't supply, as many people try and blame, you know. But on that note, something else I suppose I would touch on, just to clarify, is that of course there are issues around the market availability. You know, the result, you know, this results from stuff like all of these people who own multiple properties. You know, we've got people who own properties who deliberately leave these properties vacant just so that they can accrue interest on these properties and, you know, the price can continue to go up. And they can continue to increase their wealth. And then, you know, we've also got all of these, you know, people who have stuff like second or third holiday homes. You know, something that people don't actually need. Especially why we've got people who can't even have a house themselves. You know, people who don't even own a home. And we've got people who have second or third holiday houses. You know, I'm a big believer myself in the principle of nobody gets seconds until everybody has their first serving. You know, why should anybody be entitled to have multiple dwellings that they're not going to use for the vast majority of the year as well? They're just going to sit empty. Why we've got people who can't afford a home, who can't afford rent even. You know, absolutely ridiculous. Now, you know, something I really want to touch on here is the way that the housing market very much props up the entire Australian economy. You know, this is something that a lot of people might not necessarily be aware of. You know, at the end of the day, housing and the property market is actually Australia's biggest market. You know, there's something ridiculous like $12 trillion. You know, that's how much the property market is worth here in so-called Australia. $12 trillion. You know, it outranks all of these other industries. It's, you know, it's far larger than the Australian stock exchange. It's larger than our manufacturing sector, than agriculture. It's larger even than the mining industry that exports $500 billion worth of stolen profits off this continent every single year. You know, the housing market is bigger than all of them, and it's, you know, substantially bigger as well. And, you know, tied in with this, of course, is the banks, in particular the big four banks. You know, something like two-thirds of Australian bank lending is residential mortgages. I think it's actually over. I think it's actually closer to like 70 or 80%. You know, 70 or 80% of all of the lending that banks do in so-called Australia is around mortgages. You know, it's the housing market's literally what props up the banks here. It's what props up everything. You know, the single biggest industry. And, you know, of course, that's the way it is. You know, we've got to remember at the end of the day that this is a settler colony. You know, they came here, the settlers I'm talking about and the colonizers, they came here with the sole intention of turning this continent into a resource and an asset for them to profit off of. And that's why we are in the situation we are today, where the single biggest, you know, single biggest economic thing in this colony is, of course, the housing market. Now, what goes hand in hand with this as well is the fact that as a result of, you know, Australia hinging all of its economy around housing and around stolen property, Australia's actually got an absolutely abysmal economic complexity index. You know, we actually rank surprisingly very low on that. Australia ranks 105th in the world on economic complexity. And, you know, that's simply because we don't have many industries here. You know, the vast majority of the industry here in so-called Australia is based around stolen goods and stolen property. It's based around stolen land, you know, which is being sold and mortgaged and invested in whatever else. And it's based around, secondly, stolen resources, you know, the massive mining industry here. But yeah, you know, it's, as a result, we've got this absolutely abysmal economic complexity index. And, you know, don't get me wrong, at the end of the day, like, I'm not a supporter of Australia as the political entity. You know, I obviously don't support the settler colonial occupation of my people's land and the denial of our rights and sovereignty and self-determination and everything else that goes hand in hand with that, as well as the abysmal stats and situations that we live under here today. But, you know, just to look at things objectively and just to, like, take, my identity out of it for a moment and just to look at things as, you know, a general working class sort of person, you know, this is absolutely horrific for, you know, the average working class person. You know, this is not economically sound or safe. And, you know, don't get me wrong, again, I'm not a supporter of capitalism. I think it's a absolutely horrendous and atrocious economic system. But they're not even doing capitalism right. You know, they're not even doing it in a way where there's any sort of security or long-term prosperity for the average working class Joe on this continent. You know, there's probably not even much long-term security for most of these property owners either at the end of the day, because they've completely, you know, hinged all of their wealth around this one asset. And if the property market collapses, there goes all of their wealth, there goes all of their assets. And it's just not a very smart move by any means. It's not smart from a capitalist perspective. It's not smart from an anti-capitalist perspective. And it's just, quite abysmal. But yeah, we've got this as a result, you know, of all of these investment properties and stuff. And, you know, as I mentioned before, we've got all of these empty homes. Now, as a result, we've got all of these rising homelessness populations right across the continent. You know, homelessness is something that is becoming increasingly worse and worse every single year as a direct result of this housing market. And, you know, Australia, another little fun fact, Australia's got, you know, one of the most expensive, if not the most expensive housing market in the world. Sydney in particular, you know, I can't remember if it's number one or number two, but Sydney has either the highest or the second highest property market in the entire world. You know, and Melbourne's not that far behind Sydney either. You know, don't get me wrong, you know, it might be a little bit better down here, but it's not that much better. It's not that far behind. You know, we're very close to having, down here in Melbourne I'm talking about, very close to having one of the worst property markets in the world. You know, one of the most expensive housing markets in the world. And it's no wonder why that, you know, you've got all these people that believe that, young people in particular, who believe that they'll never be able to own their own home. Because, you know, that's the situation that's being created. And when you do create these situations where you've got people who are completely disenfranchised from future aspirations, when you've got people who think, what's the point of going and, you know, working 9 to 5 Monday to Friday and saving up this money to buy a house and, you know, to live the Australian dream when they can never achieve it? You know, you've got people who are being sold this Australian dream of your quarter acre block with your white picket fence and, you know, your wraparound porch and whatever else, but for the vast, vast majority of Australians, that's completely unattainable. Yet they're still trying to sell this dream to people. And when people finally realize, when they finally snap to and wake up to themselves and realize that, oh, actually, this dream isn't accessible to me, unfortunately, we see the vast majority of people trying to scapegoat those worse off than them and pointing their fingers to blame the completely wrong people. You know, we've got all of these right-wing chuds, for example, all of these, you know, working-class fools who have fallen in line with Pauline Hanson's propaganda and all this other right-wing propaganda who are happy to, you know, blame migrants and immigrants on the housing crisis. And the most ironic thing about it is you look at some of the people who are very key figures in these movements, and they're the ones that are actually the problem. Like, you've got that, what's that guy's name, Hugo Lennon or whatever, that Auspil idiot on social media, and yet his parents and his grandparents, you know, he's, one of his main platforms is he bangs on about how the immigrants and, you know, the migrants are causing all of the housing problem crisis, and, you know, that's the reason why we are in the situation we are today and why most working class white Australians can't afford a property. But then ironically, you go and look at this person's family and they're one of the biggest property investors in the entire colony. You know, it's absolutely ridiculous. Hugo Lennon, that's his name. yeah, you know, you go and look at his family's property stuff, and it's, give me a second, actually, I'm just going to double check something. While that lines up, I'm just going to, like, double, yeah. So, Hugo Lennon, who's, you know, this odds pill idiot, who gets on social media and wherever else and bangs on about the migrants and immigrants causing the housing crisis. And meanwhile, you know, he's got massive platform as well. You know, he blames the migrants and immigrants for the price of housing. Yet, he is the grandson of Tony Lennon, who has a housing portfolio that sits just under $1 billion. You know, these people have $1 billion worth of property here that they're just sitting on, that they're, you know, investing. You know, literally massive property tycoons. And then instead of anyone putting two and two together and realize that actually the reason I can't afford a house and the reason my rent costs so much is because people like Hugo Lennon and his grandfather own $1 billion worth of property. Now, instead, they listen to these exact people who own all this property when they turn around and try and blame the migrants and the immigrants. You know, it's a sad state of affairs that we live in here in so-called Australia. I am constantly disappointed with so much of the working class for just being so gullible and naive and, you know, just choosing to scapegoat those who are worse off than them. You know, I'm talking about like black and brown people, for example, or, you know, queer communities or disabled people or, you know, other minority demographics that are often oppressed or exploited or discriminated against. You know, yeah, absolutely ridiculous. This is why I don't have much faith in like the movements here in so-called Australia either, because, yeah, how are you meant to contend with this level of idiocy, I suppose, when you can have literally billion-dollar property investors turning around to working-class people who can't afford their own home and blaming migrants and these working-class chuds. Go and believe it. Yeah. Something needs to change. Something needs to change drastically. How that happens, I don't know.
You're listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned to hear the rest of your 3CR podcast.
Now, just before those last couple of tracks, I was talking a bit about the, you know, so-called housing crisis in this colony. And something I wanted to also touch on is the political incentives that are behind this. So, you know, we know that governments rarely look to solve or address, pardon me, their housing problem. And we know this because large voting blocks benefit from rising prices. They benefit from stuff like investment properties and the increasing inequality that is happening here. You know, the banks benefit as well from these rising prices, developers benefit, and of course the government relies heavily on stuff like stamp duty, on land taxes, and on construction activity. And of course the result of all of that is that everyone is in power is ultimately rewarded when housing and property prices continue to rise. Now, not only that, there is a large degree of opportunism that is at play here as well. You know, we've got a lot of these politicians and political parties who are looking to capitalize on stuff like the so-called housing crisis to drive up their own voting base. Now, you know, because of the way that they're going about this and because of the propaganda that they're echoing and pushing themselves and all of their nonsense rhetoric out there around, you know, blaming migrants and immigrants and, you know, what's the other stuff they blame? Stuff like environmental issues and whatever else. You know, the reason they push all this stuff is because it drives up their voting block at the end of the day. And we need only to look at parties like Pauline Hanson's One Nation to see how this propaganda is playing out in real life. Now, one really disgusting stat and figure that's associated with this is how many people, in particular, you know, self-described Pauline Hanson voters, but just people in general, are now leaning towards stuff like a reintroduction of the White Australian policy. In fact, I saw a survey recently that wanted to look at, you know, if working class people are in favour of the reintroduction of a White Australian policy for future immigration that, you know, would apparently ensure that only those from, you know, so-called compatible countries with similar living standards could come into Australia. 70% of people voted yes in support of that. You know, 70% of the people who they surveyed, 70% of those people are in favour of a White Australian policy being reintroduced. And we look at those who said no, it's less than a quarter, it's 23%. You know, there were 7%, sorry, who were, you know, not sure. But the vast majority of people, 70%, over two-thirds, nearly three-quarters of these people are in favour of a reintroduction of the White Australian policy. That is the situation that we're in now. And not only that, you know, you've got all of these other, you know, racist issues and stuff coming to the forefront as a result of the capitalization and opportunism that the politicians are, you know, using stuff like the housing crisis to push. Now, on top of that, we've also got, some other scary stats and figures out there around resurgence of right-wing colonial values. You know, there is, for example, a massive resurgence in the younger generations of Christianity. Now, you know, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that Christianity in and of itself is a bad thing or associated with fascism or anything like that. But we do know that stuff like Christianity has often in the past been used as a justification to push stuff like colonialism and conquest and assimilation. And we know that a percentage of, you know, these new rising, Christian populations in the next generation are also what we would call, you know, the Christo-fascists. You know, they're those, so-called Christians, and I say so-called because they don't actually follow their the beliefs in their religious texts. You know, they don't actually follow the word of their savior Jesus. But, you know, you've got all these, you know, so-called Christians, this massive resurgence of it in the next generation. And you've also got, you know, all of this resurgence and, you know, massive increase in stuff like, incels and, you know, the manosphere and, you know, all of these misogynistic male ideologies and, you know, massive resurgences of similar sort of stuff, you know, whether it be misogyny or racism or, you know, anti-LGBT or anti-migration and immigration or whatever it may be. But there's a massive resurgence of it lately. You know, there's a large cultural push lately to really push the working class into right-wing reactionary politics. Now, at the end of the day, you know, as I mentioned before, like, you know, this is horrible, don't get me wrong, and, you know, there's a lot of people we can blame for this, but there is a degree to which we have to point the finger at ourselves and also blame ourselves, you know what I mean? Like, there's a reason this is happening. It's because we don't have any proper left-wing movement in this colony to actually challenge the resurgence of right-wing fascist values. You know, that first and foremost is, you know, a primary issue. But the second issue is, you know, not just that, it's not just with the left, it's with just the working class in general. You know, so many people are happy to be gullible and be naive and be duped into blaming the wrong people for their issues. Now, it's not as a result of, I think it's not really, you know, fair to say that these people are just, you know, unwillingly being manipulated into these views. At the end of the day, Australia's got, for all its horrible qualities, you know, Australia does have a decent education system, for example. You know, people in Australia, generally speaking, are relatively well educated, you know, in a global scheme of things. Not only that, like, you know, don't get me wrong, it's been a while since I was in school, but I remember when I was back in high school, they even taught stuff like media literacy skills, you know, and yet nobody on the right-wing side of the working class seems to be exercising any of these media literacy skills that they were literally taught in public education. You know, it's part of the public education curriculum to learn this stuff. You know, there's no excuse, in my opinion, to to be falling for these lies and for this propaganda, except that somebody's just being lazy and they're just choosing to take the easy option, which is to point their finger at somebody who is, you know, in the social hierarchy scheme of things, is below them, and to blame those who are more vulnerable instead of actually blaming those who are causing the issues. And, you know, this is something that everybody needs to reconcile with, because at the end of the day, it's something that everybody plays a role in and everybody contributes to.
Become a 3CR subscriber today. Go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe or call the station on 03 9419 8377. Be a part of your community radio station.
Yeah, welcome back to the old lawns of Parliament House, where we're having the 40th year anniversary of the Aboriginal Tent Embassy. And throughout the day, we're going to hear from people on the ground here, including Michael Anderson, who is one of the surviving members of the Aboriginal Tent Embassy, or the only surviving member of the Aboriginal Tent Embassy. Before we do that, I'm going to talk to a veteran activist and campaigner, someone who's been involved in stolen generations, childcare, Aboriginal health, mental health, and she's been around for a long time struggling to get some sort of recognition for her people. I want to introduce you to my sister Marge, who's just come back from Tasmania, and I suppose you'd say it was the resurrection of the Aboriginal Provisional Government. Marge, you went to a meeting surrounding that sort of issue.
Yeah, thanks Rob, and there was a meeting yesterday of the Aboriginal Provisional Government in Launceston. And I'd like to read a statement out from that meeting, and it basically is the position of the Aboriginal Provisional Government from now on. It says it's the Invasion Day statement. Aboriginal Provisional Government supports Tent Embassy. The APG acknowledges the four brave men who were sent by their people to establish the Tent Embassy in Canberra in 1972. We pay respects to the brothers and sisters who used the potent message of the Tent Embassy to defend the rights of self-determination and sovereignty. It was one of the most significant acts of resistance in recent history, and the APG honours warriors from all corners of the country for their endurance and legacy. While Julia Gillard is preoccupied with meaningless constitutional reform, she is neglecting the government's fiduciary duty to deal properly with Aboriginal people. Genocide is still perpetuated through interference of state bureaucracies in the life of every Aboriginal person. Self-determination is overlooked at the height of its necessity. Constitutional debate is a distraction for the Gillard government. The proposal from the so-called expert panel is all about assimilation. Because of that, we will oppose it. The APG makes the position clear. No law that directly affects Aboriginal people should be passed without prior informed consent. In a democracy, it is the right of Indigenous peoples to select their own representatives. In the last 15 years, the opportunities for Aboriginal people to have their say has been stage managed by government and its lackeys. The agenda has been theirs, not ours. The APG met in Launceston this week to reaffirm our commitment to the continual struggle for self-determination. Our next steps will be to fostering real debate through state forums and new media. The APG reminds its supporters for the need to maintain dialogue amongst ourselves. This will determine the leaders from the lackeys. While Australians celebrate a day that represents the history of booze, barbecues, bloodshed and theft, we continue our resistance. Despite the mindless nationalism of some Australians, we remember the invasion. This is Invasion Day. Calls to have a new day are well founded. Like in New Zealand, a true national day will be the day that the government signs a treaty with the Aboriginal people. This is the day we will celebrate.
Yeah, thanks for that, Marge. And that's a statement that was made by the Aboriginal Provisional Government, who met this week in Launceston, or Hobart, was it, Marge? Hobart?
Launceston, right.
Just recently, and they've signalled their support for the Aboriginal Tent Embassy. Yeah, thanks for that, Marge.
No worries,
Rob. So what's the strategy of the Aboriginal Provisional Government? What's their new plans?
Well, the strategies. Actually, I got a new passport yesterday, and they're looking really good. I actually left it in the car. But so the website for the Aboriginal Provisional Government is www.apg, and so check it out.
Is that .gov on it?
No, .gov. So check it out, and the supporters have been with us for a long time, and you know, people have continued to struggle in their own way. What we're hoping to do is to initiate discussions about the current issues that are happening, and certainly the constitutional reform is one. So what we'd like to initiate is forums throughout the country. So if anyone is keen to get that happening, I think what we need to do amongst ourselves is educate ourselves about the issues, if we don't already know, but certainly prepare ourselves and start working out, you know, a process to continue the struggle, because it's going to keep on going for a while yet. We have to maintain the rage, I guess. Today is a day of sorrow, and it's a day for condolences, and it's a day for remembering those of our people who were fallen in the struggle. So check out the website, and we'll keep you posted.
Okay. Just tell us a little bit why it's necessary to have a sort of structure like that for Aboriginal people, a government structure. And, just give us the reasons why we need to have a structure like that. And I know it's a white man thing, but I suppose to get recognition, you have to do this. So, you know, there's many ways to liberate ourselves. The APG is possibly one of them, I suspect.
The APG stands for self-determination, and what we're saying is that we have the right to represent ourselves. That's the first principle of self-determination. And that's not only in the Declaration of Indigenous Rights. That is already a right that everybody has around the world, except for Indigenous people in this country. The provisional government is provisional until we have a treaty. And, you know, we're encouraging all arms and across the country. We don't want to be a top-heavy organisation. It's not about dictating from the top down. It's about encouraging people in communities across this country to participate and be informed and stand up and fight for a treaty, fight for self-determination and be recognised. And the same as the Black GST, you know, it's the same. There's nothing new. We're saying the same things, and it doesn't matter whether it's the APG or whether it's the Black GST or Camp Sovereignty. We've been struggling to have recognition of sovereignty. We want the right to self-determination, and we want the end of genocide in this country. That's about it.
Thank you, Marge. And Marge is the women's delegate for the new revamped Aboriginal Provisional Government. So keep your eyes out for that mob. Something that we can use in order to liberate ourselves in this country. It's one of the things that we can use. The Aboriginal Tent Embassy is Camp Sovereignty for me. This is where my understanding of sovereignty comes from. This is one little area in this country that we can call our own here. And you know, this is our bit of land, and it's probably, I call this place my home. So keep your eyes out for the APG, and if you want to get involved, check Marge out, and check out the website of the APG. Listen to 3CR Community Radio. We're streaming live, broadcasting live out of the Aboriginal Tent Embassy on the lawns of the old Parliament House. Stay tuned, 8:55 AM, Community Radio.
That was a recording of Uncle Robbie Thorpe and Auntie Marge Thorpe from the 40th anniversary of the Aboriginal Tent Embassy, which would have been, 2006, I think? Yeah, something like that. Maybe 2016. Having a bit of a mathematical mental blank, sorry. But yeah, that was at the 40th anniversary up at the Tent Embassy there. And, you know, however long ago it was, at least a decade or so ago, but we're still asking for the same things. You know, we've been asking for the same things for decades now. Our demands haven't changed. You know, we're still asking for our sovereignty to be recognised and accepted. We're still asking for our rights that our sovereignty entails, you know, our right to self-determination, our right to our lands, our right to our liberty. None of this has changed. You know, it's just the government continuing to block us at every turn and deny our birthrights as sovereign people. I'm going to play another recording. This one is of Uncle Des Blurton, who's a First Nations man from over in Borloo, or Perth as it's known today. He does a lot of really great work over in his community, especially around stuff like child removal, deaths in custody, and protecting country.
Desmond Blurton, all the way from Borloo. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, good. Yeah. That's how it works.
Yes, thank you very much. I'd like to thank Gurudjala Brother Wadanungu, 4-year anniversary. What an achievement. Brother. Also, yeah, Camp Sovereignty. Congratulations, and keep going, because nothing can deter us. Nothing. And yeah, and to the other brother who was here speaking about his country. Lucha, thank you. Yes, my name is Desmond Blurton. I'm a proud Balladong Yuid Noongar from Borloo, Perth, Western Australia. The colonialism over there has done a lot of damage to our budja, which means land. Bibbulmun budja, the Bibbulmun nation, and I'm in with the tribes, such as Balladong, Yuid, and the tribes of the southwest, such as Menang. I think Captain Bunbury came over to our tribal lands, and Captain Philippe, that guy. Yeah, there was so much destruction, such as a hanging out in Ascot. A horse track. The colony came out, settlers, to see this man get hung. And they left him up there for 30 minutes. They bring him down, not to bury him, but to take him up to my country, Balladong, York. To chain him to a tree and let him rot there so that our people will see it and will be scared of what's there. We call him Jenga. Jenga Awara, which translates to not very good. My grandfather told me stories. My auntie, lovely auntie Gwen, just passed away last year. She was the eldest of my dad's brothers and sisters. She only just passed away last year. She lived to a very nice old ripe age. She won West Australian of the Year. She was very good at keeping our family together. And I don't know about Dad, but he was a bit of a... But he knew the importance of protecting family. Because Granddad, there was no heat. He wouldn't take his family into the town, fearing that they're going to get taken from him. So he took his family out in the bush to stay there, fearing that colonialism, redcoats, will take his family once they see his children. Granddad was strong, one hard person. You mess with his family, you mess with him. And he was not a big man in stature, but his values for his family were through and through. He worked cleaning toilets in York. He didn't want to go to the war. What's out there for the war for us other than destruction? We don't belong in wars. Why? Because we have our nations on our land and we keep the peace. We know our boundary lines. We know where they end and stop. Because our creators have given them to us. But over colonization, they change. We know where they stop and we know where they start. And that's important to give to our children. With the mission days, yeah. I don't know, I've been told a few mission stories when I was 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I'd lay there and listen to the mission stories about sheephead soup every night. Sheephead soup. They would work out in the vegetable garden and get all the fresh fruit and veggies. None of them was going to any of our mob. They would go to the mission staff. So they'd have to steal an orange or an apple that was dirty, rotten or something, but just tap it off. A.O. Neville, you may have heard of him over there. We call him Aaron the Devil from our mob. The destruction in those missions, ethnic cleansing. Read Bible. Clothes equals food. Everything's got to equal up to food. Give us rations. Chuck a ration out here, there. Chuck a ration, and that they right. They got a mesh bag. They can go out in the community there. They can go around and collect off the curb. We still do that today. Sorry for my voice. We still do that today. Over there in Western Australia and everywhere else, shoot to kill policies on our people. Martial law. They know it because they will get off. Because they have their all-white juries. I'm a part of Deaths in Custody Watch Committee in Western Australia, and I've been campaigning to ban all-white juries. Because I know that our people are getting maximum sentence no matter what. And when a trial is being presented to the community, they will get the jury from the rich area of whatever. So they're going to come there and give us the maximum sentence. No ways. New South Wales University was giving that a bit of flack. So I am going to reactivate that soon. And I hope everyone looks out for that, because that's an important part where the justice system has maybe got a lady at the front and there's a scales where it's supposedly equal. This is the scales. We want that balance. Only way we can balance that is we do it ourselves. I do a lot in with homeless too. You know. What is the most depressing? I don't know. But to me, being homeless is so hurtful. There's nothing out there. This is our bush. Whether it's on, you put concrete over it, it's still our sacred tribal lands. Concrete don't make it nothing except sealing what's underneath. And I feel that our ancestors are underneath these concrete pillars. Over there, we had executions. Yagan, you may have heard of Yagan. His dad, Major Gerda, faced a firing squad. It's not even... Just a couple of years ago, an Aboriginal lady from Geraldton, six police jumped out in front of her. Within 2 to 3 seconds, she also got a firing squad put on her. And these people get off because of all white juries. Our sovereignty is so important. Our sovereignty is so important to our movement. And I thank Robbie, Claude, what they're doing here in Naarm to keep that fire alive. That fire alive is flickering. It's flickering. It's maybe it goes to amber, but that light don't go out. And fire keepers, keep that fire burning.
That was a recording of Des Blurton speaking out of the event over here in Naarm. And, you know, he touches on some very important issues, especially around the whole campaign to end all-white juries, which is a campaign that we've seen here in so-called Australia, but also in places like the United States who have very similar issues in regards to racial judicial systems.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.